This is Seeds Podcast, bringing you tips, conversations, and information about applied behavior analysis.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our second episode of this season. And in this season's podcast, the theme is an inclusive education roadmap. And again, in this episode, we have our very own special education program coordinator, Jack, joining us. Hi, Jack. Hello again.
Hi. Good to be back.
Yeah. So if you would like to know more about Jack's journey as a special educator, you can tune in to our previous episode where Jack shared a lot of her experiences journeying with children of with special needs in different education setting, and her thoughts about schooling and her thoughts about inclusion as well. And this episode today, we're going to talk a little bit about bridging the gap. I think Jack, remember last episode we spoke about there are some gaps in our system, in our education system. So I thought in this episode, we may want to discuss some unique learning needs that we may need to explicitly teach some of our students so they can continue to thrive in different kinds of school setting. And so remember we spoke about a vision of special needs students' education roadmap, right?
Yeah.
And you shared with us some factors that affects inclusion. Some are systemic, and we are going to need to be a little bit more patient while, you know, some of us advocate for inclusion and get the ball rolling and also start to hold ourselves to very high accountability when we do say that we are doing inclusion. So that's gonna take time, and also you know, with policies, changes in the policy, education policy, national education policy, that's also going to take some time, one step at a time. So we then spoke about what we can come back to our learners, what we can do and think about while we wait for the systemic change to happen. How can we prepare our learners, better prepare our learners for school and within the system that we have right now? So I thought in today's episode, we can zoom in a little bit about these and how we can equip our students in a group setting, right?
Yep.
So the first question to you, Jack, is, remember we tried to answer the question of, how long does my child need to be in a one-on-one setting before he can transition to a school setting, right? That's common one. What are some of the deciding factors that a student, that may show that a student is ready to transition into a group environment? And in your opinion, what are some barriers that may hinder this transition process?
I think, referring back to our the first episode, our conversation in the first episode, like you mentioned earlier as well, the education roadmap, right? So some of the factors, because we were saying that not every child has to go through the one-to-one and then small group and then school, right? Some kids can go one-to-one straight into school. Some kids may need to go through every step. Some kids may need help in school. So it really varies, and I think your question was like, what are some of the factors and barriers, right? So again, going back to the first episode, I think I gave you a very short and simple answer when you asked, do all schools have the same expectations, right? The short and simple answer was no. And then I think I remember you saying you're not happy with that answer, right? but yes, it's true. Is that true? But a lot of schools have different expectations, right, in terms of school readiness, and I think that's quite normal as well. You know? So some schools may be more academically driven. So they have more academic expectations. Students that come in have to be able to do certain things academically, have to be able to achieve some level of academic achievement. Some other schools are more focused on social communication expectations. So they ensure their students has speech, verbal speech, can socialize with their peers, able to request and certain things. But I think foundationally beneath all these expectations, whether academic or more social, I think the foundation of the very, very basic skill that is needed to support these expectations is learning behaviors, right? So the question we want to ask is, are our children able to learn, able to
in a group setting?
Yes, in a group setting. Our children able to learn classroom routines, classroom rules, school rules, and many other abstract expectations. I wish I can bold my speech. Abstract expectations, you know. So I think that's the question. That's the main barrier.
Why abstract expectations?
Actually, it's funny because this morning I was listening to the radio and I actually heard an announcement. It's a PSA, and it said this is an unspoken rule about standing on the escalator. An unspoken rule about standing on the escalator is you need to stand on the left.
Yeah.
Right? And why is it an unspoken rule? Because everyone's supposed to know it. Right? But it's a rule. It's a social rule. So those are things I call abstract expectations. So abstract concepts. Because how do we know standing on the left is good manners on, you know what I mean? Abstract because I think there are a lot of routines and things we do in life that are very, very abstract to us, more so to students who are neurodiverse, right? We expect everyone to know, like, that's what you're supposed to do, you know, but
no. True. So I guess in some ways we may take classroom routines and classroom rules for granted, that when the kids, all these foundational skills that you mentioned, like social communication, like foundational social communication, toilet train, starting to have some emerging social skills with their peers. But when they're being put in a group setting or like a classroom setting, there are these factors where the abstract expectations come into play that may hinder them on showing these skills that they
have.
That's very interesting because I can see how neurodiverse learners, some they can be quite literal.
Yes.
And this is what you taught me, and this is how I, you know, show my skills when it's being taught. But I can see how in a classroom it may be like it's a loose environment. It can be unpredictable.
Unpredictability is a big one. Never know what's going to happen. Every day you can have snack, but every snack time can be very different.
I like how like we know, but it may be abstract to our learners.
So to give you an
they don't know, right?
And I think to give you an example, like in a common school day, right, there are actually so many transitions that happen throughout a school day, and it's very abstract, you know, because to us it's like, oh yeah, okay, first this, then this.
What kind of transitions?
If you can. For example, like transitioning from arrival to the first class, transition from the second class to snack time. Even in snack time, there's so many transitions.
Go wash hands. It's not just eating, right?
Just eating. There's so many things that's lining up, and that's grabbing their snacks, and then that's lining up. But even in lining up, if they're at the front of the line, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. If they're in the middle of the line, what does that mean? If they're at the end of the line, what does that mean? The waiting time is different. Everything changes for the child, right? And these kind of
unspoken. Everything changes. Yeah. So if you're in the first in line to go wash hands, and then you're done, what do you do?
What happens? Yes. If you're the first in line and you go, you have to wash your hands and you get your snack. Maybe there are a few seats or tables that are meant for for my class to sit at. Okay, so I know. But where do I sit? Okay, or maybe I will know where to sit. But then if I am in the middle of the line, after washing my hands, I can see like, oh, my friends are sitting there, or I know those people. It's easier for me to know where to sit, maybe.
Like there's a natural prompt there.
Natural cue, yes. Yeah. Whereas if I'm at the end of the line and I wash my hands, so earlier we said it's a natural cue because we see our friends seated.
Yeah.
The end of the line, and by the time I wash my hands and go to where I'm supposed to sit, I realize that all the seats are taken up that day. What do I do? And that's why I say, like, just lining up can be so abstract already, because where I'm positioned in the queue, in the line, will make a big difference to the learner, right, on what to do next. And then can break down the entire transition already. Because if I don't know where to sit, I don't know if I can eat, I don't know how I feel about this situation, I don't know if I can get help. Snack time can be a lot going on.
And then I think if I open my snack bag, it's not my favorite snack.
It's not my favorite snack. That's right.
I can see how like the picture in my head, right? And we're just only talking about lining up.
Yes.
So many transitions in different between activities or like recess going back to classroom or classroom going out to recess.
Even I don't have the food I like, but the next person next to me has actually something I like. Can I have that person's food? Probably not. Or when I'm done eating, what do I do? I see other people who are done eating, they can play. But by the time I finish eating, I hear a bell and I don't get to play. I have to leave. So there are all these different kinds of expectations, situations, but we expect learners to already know because it's an unspoken rule.
True. And these kind of scenarios usually only naturally happen in school, in a group setting,
in a group setting, exactly. So,
you mentioned earlier, there are different school rules in different schools, but generally the expectation is you need to be able to be independent.
Yes.
In knowing what to do in
knowing
all
what these to do. Knowing the classroom routines, the classroom rules, and being okay with it. I think that's also another very important point. Not only do you have to know, but you also have to just be okay with it. And we know neurodiverse learners, not all neurodiverse learners are okay with change, just like that, right? We want to know, and we want to be prepared. So yeah, I could spend a whole episode just talking about snack time, honestly.
I know.
And how much, how how much of expectation there there is, and how abstract the concept of snack time and the transition can be. So these kind of concepts have to be taught, have to be practiced.
And it can be taught. It can be taught.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. It can be set up in a group setting, and it can be set up very naturally in a group setting as well.
So why can't they learn these? Just go to a school and learn the routine.
I guess they can, but I think more often than not, this is where the breakdown happens, because it's too big a group, maybe, and too short a time to realize, like, oh, okay, so let's say snack time is 30 minutes, 25 minutes long. And to learn this, it will have to be in a natural setting where it just happens to me. And then by the time I learn and understand everything, the next bell is off and I need to
go. Right. And you got to move on to the next.
I got to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one. Two, you know, getting teachers to attend to teach that one student on the whole process. That's going to take up a lot of time. That's going to probably hold back the rest of the class. Yeah, so there's going to be a lot of, I guess, a lot of interruptions if, you know, we jump straight into school setting. Okay, this is what it is. But there is, I'm sure, a small percentage of neurodiverse learners who can, assimilate and who can adapt pretty quickly. But I think on average, quite a number of students will require maybe a smaller group before going into a school setting, which is quite a large group.
Again, like acquisition rate, like, I guess, like how fast a learner acquire an abstract concept, right?
Absolutely.
What about following instructions? So like for me, you know, reflecting back on my kindy primary school journey, I remember, like, I think all of us audience will also, you know, remember that's just a lot of instructions, a lot of instructions. Or maybe I went for like a very traditional kind of school. So sometimes we find some children, they are doing really, really well. And, in our one-on-one setting, we make sure that, you know, they're at least able to follow multiple steps instruction. They are cooperative, very ready to receive instructions. But when they then transition to a bigger group setting, and then there's the contrast, there's like, there's feedback, you know, how come he's not as independent as what we have seen at home, or like, you know, in one-on-one setting.
I think definitely there will be a difference between providing an instruction to one individual versus choral instructions. That means giving an instruction to a group of people, right? Or group of students. And I think the very fact that one-to-one setting is exactly one-to-one, the environment itself acts as a cue already that there's no one else around. So even in a one-to-one setting, if you say, everybody,
let's it must be me, right?
It has to be me. There's nobody else here. So it has to be me. So chances are the learner will follow the instruction, will be able to listen to the instruction clearly and follow through. And so, I know in a lot of places, simulating a group or classroom setting is very common, right? During one-to-one, it's very common. So, but in reality, that is quite unnatural because...
Yeah, like you said.
Who are we kidding, right?
The student definitely knows.
Definitely knows. But then the teachers, I mean, it's good intention, right? We really want to teach choral instruction. And what's a choral instruction saying? Everyone, all class, let's go, you know. But for the student, if there's no other peer, gotta be me.
You can use everyone, everybody, however much the environmental cue is.
But
there,
it's gonna be me. Yes. Eventually I will learn that no matter what you say, I will do it because it's an instruction. Mm-hmm. But this actually makes generalizing difficult for the learner in future. Because right now they're learning to follow every instruction. They're not actually learning the difference between an individual instruction versus a choral instruction. Or even calling a different name.
Right.
You know, like calling a different name in a one-to-one setting. It's quite funny, but it happens.
It's quite funny. Now I imagine, so like if let's say it's just you and me and you're my student, and then I say, Jack, do this, or like everyone do this, and then all of a sudden I say, Ashley, do this.
Yeah.
Well, that's so weird.
So I know you are teacher Alexa, I know I'm Jack. Where's Ashley?
But that was done with the intention to help them discriminate when your name is being called, you respond. If another person's name is being called, you don't respond.
Yes.
With the intention to prepare them to have the skill in the group setting.
Fair enough.
Right.
Yes. But the ultimate goal is to have peers, right? Is to actually be in a group.
Yes.
Because if we continue to use this other name or say everybody, but then your setting is always going to be one-to-one, the child is not going to be able to generalize this skill into a group setting,
right?
So that's why a lot of times when students transition from one-to-one into group setting, everyone's like, oh, but he could do choral instruction in one-to-one, how come he can't do it in a group setting? That's because there is a gap.
Yeah,
you know, that was missing.
Yeah.
So a child is basically trained to respond to instructions in general,
So I guess then, you know, this skill again, like you said, that's a gap. That's really a gap. And the way to go about it is to teach it in the environment that they are supposed to use that skill in.
Yes. And it can just be one or two other peers at least.
Yeah.
You know.
And again, I guess the ratio, like the reason is so that it's like what you mentioned earlier, easier for a teacher to teach, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely easier for teachers to teach. It's more natural. And it really acts as a stepping stone, you know, smaller group settings. So from one to one, a smaller group, at least I have a couple of peers around me, not like 10 other peers, but two or three other peers. And so now I really do need to know Ashley is a real person and Ashley's gonna answer, and everybody means all of us have to respond, not just me.
Right. And in the process, you know, the waiting, the time as well. Oh yeah, I have a it reminded me of like an example, because like in one-on-one setting, there's just, even if we want to train like waiting and doing independent tasks, right? That's only like so much you can do, and it's not natural again.
That's a good point, because in a group, even in a small group, when the teacher asks someone else a question, that time of waiting matters. It does, because in a one-to-one setting, if you simulate like, Ashley, answer this, there's no waiting time, because you don't actually hear another voice answering. The teacher doesn't lose their attention from you. So you don't really have to wait. much. It's not a realistic waiting time. But
realistic waiting time. Yeah. I think you're very small.
Yeah, if you do have a small group of students, then you can really experience that waiting time. Mm. You can experience listening to another person responding to the instruction, not you responding. So then it becomes realistic. Then the ability to generalize becomes easier to a larger setting.
I can imagine if the student is in a class of 15 to 20 students, they're doing circle time for responding, the wait time is so long.
Yes, absolutely.
When you mentioned about realistic waiting time, it's not possible to simulate it and then expect them to be able to without the stepping stones.
The simulation won't be 100%. Even taking attendance, taking attendance has a lot of waiting time, has a lot of time. But then in a one-to-one setting also, it's like, are you going to just say random things? Down the list.
Well, even if they do stay, it's again, like you say, the environmental cue is just you and me.
Yeah, it's just you and me. I don't hear any other voice responding. Yeah. I don't see any other peers.
Great. I love all these examples. And I think that is exactly why it's important to have an avenue for the students to go to work on these expectations, explicitly work on them, right?
Yes.
Abstract. We can't expect them to immediately get the expectation. Mm-hmm. When we place them into school. Yeah. So just now we talk a little bit about waiting and then independent work time, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing, right? So I know in schools, there definitely will be time given to students where they're required to work on assigned tasks on their own, right? The teacher everybody, take your worksheet, sit down. Work. So this is again like faulty stimulus control, right? The environmental cue is again there if we try to simulate it in a classroom. And I'm not gonna lie, I've done that before.
me too.
I keep telling parents like you can't do, I fade already, I walk, the room is very big, I walk to the end and then make him sit there. So this is knowing the expectation, how's that if we were to work on this goal in a one-on-one setting versus a small group setting, what's gonna be the difference there in terms of independent work time?
Right. So so when I was in school, working in school, when I was working at a school, I realized independent work time is quite common, from kindergarten. Independent work time already is implemented right up to year 12. And I think the one variable is the duration. Right. So as a kindy student, your independent work time maybe is 5 minutes or 3 minutes, where you color a worksheet or you do something, but it is independent work time.
Right.
And then as you grow older, your independent work time increases from 10, 15 minutes, half an hour, 40, 45 minutes, or the whole period, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think things like working on independent group time in a one-to-one setting versus a group setting. So one thing I can think of is having the teacher or the therapist sitting right next to the student. So in a one-to-one setting, chances of the teacher being in a closer proximity with the student is higher, right? The chances are higher. So then that can act as a prompt for the student to continue the task. So it's not that the student being independent, the student the learner thinks they have to continue the task because the teacher is right there. So even in a one-to-one setting, there is a way where the teacher can fake themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they can look away, maybe mm-hmm. they can increase their distance,
mm-hmm.
or maybe the teacher can be occupied with something else. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that the learner knows you're my teacher.
Yeah.
Even if you're not looking,
it's just me and you in the room. So it's
just me and you. And I know that after this task, we're going to go back to normal. It's going to be me and you again.
Yeah, right.
So compared to a group setting, where yes, a teacher can still be there, but again, the environment serves as a prompt, right? So you can see everyone has a task to do, has a task to complete. The teacher may or may not be attending to a student, may or may not be in the room even, may or may not be looking at us. So that already is a very, very big difference from a one-to-one setting to a small group setting in terms of independent tasks.
Yeah.
So I think independent, like working on independent work time is meant to be a learning goal in a group setting or like a school readiness program more so than in a one-to-one. My rationale is that in one-to-one, right, I think the whole expectation of one-to-one is that the learner receives the one-to-one attention. So why are we fading our attention? Why are we walking away and ignoring the child? You know, of course the intention is to train independence. But in a one-to-one setting, again, it's not natural. It defeats the purpose of one-to-one.
Mm-hmm.
It defeats the whole objective of being in a one-to-one setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if the intention is to work on independence, that means parents and educators need to think of, okay, if the child's in one-to-one and we want to have, we want to implement more, or we want to include more independent work time goals, this is already a sign where, okay, the student should, we should be thinking about moving the student to a small group.
He's ready to learn these skills in the small group setting, the environment is with the natural cue, and this skill is meant to be worked on in kind of environment.
And it can even be from a small group as a pair.
That
can already make a difference.
Oh, you know, when you talk about pair, I just reminded of the conversation that we just had in your classroom, where three boys, they now learn that my pair is working on something, I also need to be working on something. In a way, it also motivates them to...
The natural cue. Absolutely. And it's lovely to learn in a natural setting. It is very, very lovely to see learners learn you know, these learning behaviors in a natural setting, because these are abstract expectations. These things happen in life, in school, you know, and unpredictability is something we spoke about. So it's very nice to see you know, the environment being the teacher and us being the facilitator, us facilitating the environment.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think, it's important. I feel like, yes, we set up this, the education roadmap into one, to small group of care, and then, you know, leading to school with or without help. It's important for us to have that plan. But ultimately, we are aiming for independence. And what does independence mean, right? It means going out there in the world. So we act as educators, we act as facilitators to facilitate these kind of
How you
this kind of experiences for them. It's nice. It's nice to watch.
I was going to say in one of the one of the principle of applied behavior analysis is generality, like how we always, when we design a goal and we decide to teach this skill to the student, we have to already plan out how generalizable this skill is going to be, and how we look into planning for generalization of the skills. Yeah. One of it is also to teach the skill in the environment, like you were very spot on, just reminded me, you know, all this we're still adhering to the behavioral principles of teach the skill where the skill is meant to happen.
Yes.
Then we will be successful, yes. Rather than, yeah, if there's no avenue, then we have to do what we have to do. But I guess if there's an avenue, then quick, like after they've done their foundational skill, bringing down their behavioral challenging behaviors, and then give them the avenue to explicitly learn these skills.
Yeah,
and I think in your classroom, you know, the boys in your classroom, I have worked with them one-on-one, and I've seen how when we put them in that environment, the environment is the best teacher.
Really is. Of course, it will take some time, you know, to adapt and to learn about the environment. But once the environment is set, then they know, then the abstract expectations come in.
Yeah.
And that's where we facilitate the teaching for these abstract expectations.
And just like you mentioned about progression of independent work. So the bigger picture is we want to have them be independent and then generalize to very, very long duration. And I think you put it really nicely. I think just with all these skills, right, it's just like any other skills that we teach, like social communication skill, even like if I were to compare it to fine motor skills, for example, you know, how like initially fine motor skill we start with like easier ones, and then like if the attention is not that great, we start with 2 beats, then 4 beats, then eventually the whole thing 10 beats, right? I guess it, if I can, correct me if I'm wrong, compare it that way, it's the same with these skills, right? These abstract classroom rules and classroom expectation. When you talk about the duration of independent tasks, I just remember it's similar, isn't it? Like you start with like where the kindy level is, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and then eventually age appropriate level of like 10 minutes, then 15 minutes. Right. And then I think at the same time, also, you know, skills of like not just sitting there and completing the task by themselves, like just like you mentioned, like, do I ask for help? When I'm done, what do I do after? So as well, like planning, executive functioning,
organization.
If it's not taught explicitly, I think for some learners, I can see how confusing it can be.
Yes, it definitely can be. I mean, the fact that it's already like abstract, one, and two, I think society deem it as unspoken, where sometimes we may overlook and we take it for granted, you know. Because we are able to do it seamlessly, or neurotypical students are able to do it seamlessly. So sometimes this happens in schools a lot, where teachers find it quite, you know, maybe frustrating sometimes, like, the rest of the students can, why can't you, you know? Because it's unspoken, you know? It's something that everyone expects everyone else to know, but it unfortunately, it's not like that for neurodiverse learners. While we talk about these abstract expectations and how students can thrive school setting or in group setting, it does and it will require our children, our learners to be flexible, to be organized, to be able to learn to sequence, and like you said, you know, organizational skills, executive functioning, it will require these skills, which again need to be taught.
I think that's the gist of it. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that, because for the longest time, I think the gap has always been, the struggle has always been, you know, for everyone, you know, for the parent, for us interventionists, and for teachers, you know, we think that they're ready, they get put into school, and then the breakdown happened, the feedback happened. So now, you know, realizing that, looking at, you know, these are also skills to be taught, and also to be taught in the right setting. Number one, they are skills to be taught just like any other skills, and they have to learn in the right setting, not the very act up. Well, we've come to the end of this episode. And we hope that this episode clarifies some of the very important unique learning needs, and clarifies why, you know, there is such a gap between one-to-one therapy to simulating transitioning to schools. And thank you very much for all your very engaging and relatable examples that you gave to us. And we will see you in the next episode.
Yep, see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Seeds Podcast. We'll see you in the next episode.